Welcome to Inside Situation, a bi-weekly podcast where we share with you some of the conversations we're having inside the agency. I'm Peter Yajicek, head of technology at Situation, and I am so happy to celebrate the return of our triumvirate with Jordan Person, head of new business and special projects, and Kevin McCauley, brilliant creative mind. Hello, guys. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
So glad to be back, Peter.
So glad to have you. It's been over a month. We had some crazy, amazing guests in the interim, but I feel like we're back home now. I feel like we're back on home base. We're going to have a roundtable conversation today. Each one of us brought something to talk about, and of course, we're going to share something that we don't think our listeners should miss. So let's just kick it right off. Let's get right into it.
Great.
Jordan, what have you brought to the roundtable today for the podcast?
So I have a big topic.
Yeah.
A big topic that I've been trying to wrap my head around, and I feel like probably a lot of listeners maybe are feeling the same way. So obviously there's been, you know, since we last met, some not so great happenings around the world, particularly as it relates to ISIS. And something that I've been reading about, especially this week, because we have a potential president, Hillary Clinton, who has made statements in addition to our current president, Obama, who has also made statements this week talking about how technology companies need to be far more aggressive in monitoring terrorist content and taking it down. And then you've got technology companies on the other side, primarily Twitter and Facebook, when you read all of these articles. I specifically am talking about an article that was written in the New York Times on the 7th. But usually it's Twitter and Facebook that they're talking about, and you've got them on the other side saying, we can't do that. So, but then you have people who say, okay, well, similar software or tools or solutions have been put together when it comes to tracking and eliminating child pornography. So it can be done. It just is a matter of prioritization. So I guess the question that I throw out to the group, and Peter, I really look at you from a technology perspective, is what is possible and who's telling the truth and who's not? And I'm sure there's a lot of gray area here.
Sure.
Is the bottom line. But yeah, I just look to you to say, what's your take on this?
Well, I listened to a really great security podcast called Security Now from the TWiT Network. And that is really where I get my education on both the politics and the ethics and the technology surrounding kind of encryption, which is a big piece of what you're talking about. You know, and the ability for law enforcement to get access to things that live on remote servers, remote computers, and phones. And it is. It's a minefield. It's a minefield of conflicting opinions. And I think, you know, there was, after Edward Snowden came out and revealed the fact that there was a bunch of surveillance going on that we weren't aware of,
mm-hmm.
I think there was a real backlash on behalf of a lot of the technology companies to say, you know, you've made us look foolish. You know, there's a lot of stories out there about, you know, government overreach where they basically demanded that technology companies build in backdoors, build in a way, a secret key to get access, whether it's encryption to information that's encrypted on a computer or to monitor surveillance and monitor network traffic. There's a few different elements to it, but pretty much about 3 to 4 months ago, most of the technology companies, Apple included, were very firm about saying, we are not going to give anyone, including ourselves, the ability to decrypt this information. If we can't give it to you, then it doesn't exist. If that information is on someone's phone. So there is a way for them to build the technology where nobody can get it. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, really, one of the things that it comes down to is it's just math. Encryption is math, and math is known in the world. If you encrypt something strongly enough, you know you need an army of supercomputers to try and decrypt it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where governments came to the table, where they were really asking, you know, the technology companies to build in these back doors, to build in these openings, and the response for the tech companies was really, well, but if we build it in for you, then it's built in permanently in the next administration or the administration 10 times down the line who doesn't have a good use for it could take advantage of it. Once the hole is in there, mm-hmm. anybody could exploit it. So let's build something that can't have a hole in it. In a nutshell, that is some of what the argument is. Now, I think in the spirit of compromise, what I've heard lately is that you know, some technology companies and some technologists are saying, sure, we'll build in the ability, if you have a warrant, to decrypt this information. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to be there just wholesale at the level of anybody could do. You know, what we don't want to do is just have it be secretive where, you know, certain agencies can just do whatever they want and there's no accountability. But the same way that if you get a warrant, you can go into someone's house, but you have to have that warrant first. So I think, you know, that it's a long explanation, but I think you hit it exactly right, Jordan. It's a contentious issue. It's something that, you know, it's very easy to stay principled about, but to your point, you know, we don't just want to make it so that anybody who wishes to be a bad actor has a whole new set of tools that have never existed. Ever since technology's been around, we've had the ability to tap phones. You know, a guy could be on a telephone pole putting a pair of alligator clips on something and listen to your calls. So what's really different now is the encryption has never been as easy as it is now, where everyone's phone is a supercomputer and can encrypt things like they never could before. So I don't know where it's going to all shake out, but I think it's good that these conversations are happening. And, you know, it's hard to argue in the event of some tragedy that you don't want to make sure that law enforcement can do its job.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way you explained that makes perfect sense to me. I feel like because to give an example, it seems like if you're building a home or any building, if you're building a structure, it's irresponsible to not provide, let's say, an emergency exit to that structure, exit or entrance or whatever. So therefore, if something is going on inside, whether it be a tragic accident or something illegal that is going to require someone to come in and fix, let's say, or to stop, that's what that emergency exit is for. So it seems like a very solid compromise that's online, even though I know you do have people like Apple who are saying, basically, we're building this and it is what it is, and we're not going to have access to it, and no one else is going to have access to, you know, let's say, like you're saying, a backdoor entrance. But in a sense, it seems irresponsible not to have something, at least within the right set of regulations, so that, like you're saying, whether it is a warrant. Again, this is like the Wild West, uncharted territory.
Right.
Only because if there is information that's available on one of these platforms that hinges some sort of very important information as it relates to tracking down the San Bernardino killers or tracking down, you know, all of these, there's unfortunately so many examples we could pull from, then I don't know. It seems like, wow, it's crazy that you couldn't have access to that. But that being all said, I watched the Edward Snowden documentary. So I'm like, you know, totally also aware of just the craziness that is or can be unregulated surveillance. You know, so hard.
If you think about it in a different way and take it away from the technology for a second, let's just say, let's use the analogy of somebody's house.
Yeah.
Should it be possible for a locksmith to build a lock for your home that can't be picked? Like that's just an analogy to think about it. So if right now somebody gets a warrant to come search your house, they can do that. They can kick in the door. Mm-hmm. But this is really, it's hard to make equivalencies with technology because there's nothing that's been as stymieing as encryption technology is now. There isn't a lock that you can't kick in. There isn't a door that you can't get through if you try hard enough. So it's really about a difference in degrees of this is something we've never had before. We've never had the ability for anybody on the street to encrypt something that will never be readable by another set of eyes. Mm-hmm. It's a new thing to the equation. And I think we're still trying to figure out what the ramifications are of that. There's a part of me that believes that we have that right. We have that right to privacy. I have a right to, you know, make sure that the information that I have is secured. And again, because it's math, it's easy. It's so easy to secure right now. It doesn't cost me anything if I want to encrypt my entire hard drive.
So here's a question as it relates to that, though, when you say it is math. So then if that's the case, why is it so, what's the shift where, why is it so well encrypted? You know, like what's the degree where all of a sudden the access that I have on my own kind of Mac laptop allows me to encrypt something so powerfully that it will take a flotilla of Mac laptops to divide. I don't know.
For the longest time, so much of the information we were sending and sharing on the internet was incredibly insecure.
Mm-hmm.
So networks at their core want to share data. They want email is one of the most insecure methods of communication on the planet. And it's so intentionally so that anybody on any platform using any device can interpret what's coming over.
Right.
So, you know, I think the encryption came out of the desire to secure that stuff so that if I'm sitting in a coffee shop, you know, anybody could be sitting in a coffee shop and be sniffing around the packets and could read everything for everybody on that network if it's not encrypted. So that is what led us to say, you know what, we need to be smarter about that because that causes a lot of fraud. It's in the best interest of banks to make sure that encryption is easy.
Right.
But then once you have encryption, you can encrypt everything. So there's no, you know, it is a necessary part of what the commerce and the information that's online. But it once you have that, you can make it so hard that everything is invisible.
So if it is just math, this is more like a theoretical question. Is it safe to say then that there's going to be some development by some super genius 10, 15, 20, 100 years from now that is almost the reverse, some sort of de-encryption key, like a master key that somehow reverses this now this idea of like democratized encryption?
And I'm not going to be able to explain it as well as some, but it's really a matter of processor speed and the number of computations you can try.
Right.
If you've ever seen some things about the Enigma machine, you know, theoretically given enough time, when we're talking billions of years, you can crack anything. It's just when encryption systems are set up, usually if they're done well, you can try to guess at something and then you have to wait a physical period of time before you can try again.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to quickly make that into the millions of years.
Yes.
Into the billions of years.
Yeah.
So given enough processor power, yes, theoretically, if you had a universe full of processors and you aimed it at one thing, maybe in a million years, you could probably crack it.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to get into those numbers of scale that are crazy that it becomes practically impossible.
Yeah.
But going back to what you were saying before, Peter, and this also goes to your Wild West example, like there has to be a threshold. And I don't mean to oversimplify a very complicated issue, but there has to be a point where government agencies and technology providers, product providers get together and they acknowledge this is a thing that's happening. We have to fix it.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that people have to like call for it. Like it seems to me like it should be natural, working together. Not everybody's stuff has to be able to be encrypted. They shouldn't be able to go after everything freely, but there has to be a point where they go, oh, this is a real problem. We need to work together on this. And I don't know, again, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but it's hard for me to wrap my head around how that doesn't happen.
Well, I think you make a really good point, Peter, that I hadn't really connected the dots on before when you say that, you know, these like technology provider or these brands, whatever they are, whether it's a Verizon or whoever, where they feel like toward the government, this amount of distrust from the sense of like, we were doing that and you screwed it up and there's an element of
being treated as a cooperation. I think you're right, Kevin. I think a lot of technology companies were embarrassed and they were strong armed into situations that once they became public, it just wasn't handled very well.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot of cooperation and Project Prism and things like that were scooping up all this information. But there have been bad actors on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is going to settle out someplace that is a little bit more cooperative because nobody wants to keep encouraging kind of the terrorist activity that is impenetrable. We all want that to stop. But at the same time, it has to be open. It has to be transparent what we're doing.
It was just so interesting when I was reading these articles when it talked about how the terrorist organizations, like Twitter handles, for example, they gave an example of one that is now on its 335th iteration, where it's literally, you know, as if I would name my Twitter handle Jordan1, and every time I get shut down by Twitter, I'm now Jordan2, shut down, now Jordan3, you know. So it's crazy. So you know that Twitter, whoever it is, they're they're doing what they can right now, but there is an element of.
And to play devil's advocate, though, to the point about how the, you know, those providers were, they felt betrayed by the government, though. At some point, like, pride cannot get in the way of the bigger issues. Like, it's just not worth it at this point. You know what I'm saying? It's just hard to comprehend, really.
I think you're right, Kevin. I don't think we should let pride get in the way, but there's also, there's a lot of understanding that has to happen. I think there's education that has to happen on behalf of lawmakers. Because like I said, this is not something we've ever dealt with before. And I applaud lawmakers who are attempting to understand it, but it's not like you can have some encryption. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can either have this security or you can have it not, but it's kind of a binary state. If somebody has access, anybody could potentially have access. So that actually segues kind of nicely into the topic that I wanted to bring to the roundtable today, which was about the VTech hack. So VTech was a corporation that lost some of its information. Hackers went in to an unsecure website and stole a bunch of information like we're used to hearing about for lots of different companies. But I think what made this one unique recently was there was child information. So VTech is a company that makes kind of child learning toys, like kid iPads and things like that. And as part of the registration process, some of the information about the kids, including photos, was stored on their website. And this information is now loose into the world. And I think a lot of people are looking at this one differently. And it goes back to the idea that if none of our data can be secured because it has to be accessed and anyone is hackable, one of the things that I always say is you don't mess around with kids or cash registers. Financial information, child information, COPPA compliance laws are on the books for a reason. And I think this one is just brings a new chapter to this conversation about we want our kids to have these amazing toys, these fancy things. We want them to personalize them and we want the toys to call our kids by name and do all that stuff. But that just means that information lives in a server and then somebody has access to it. So I don't know. Does this new wrinkle in this kind of same old story, does it guys make you think any differently about security of information?
Yes. No, to me, I'm like, oh my gosh, as if you have enough to worry about for anyone that has a child. Now you've got to add this to the list. You know, it seems like one more thing. And I'm trying to even think of if there is something that when I was this age or when my parents were this age or even my grandparents, if there was something that feels analogous to this. But this does feel like just completely new frontier in the sense that there's holding that even faux iPad, VTech iPad, whatever it is, in your hand as a child, I feel like there is a sense probably, I don't know, I don't have kids, but I imagine as a parent, there's something about the kitty look of the iPad that would make you feel like, oh, they're safe. I don't have to worry about,
right.
Them accessing information they shouldn't or going somewhere where their information is going to be accessed. So I imagine as a parent, it feels even more just like, oh my gosh, what are you?
Well, I think that was one of the benefits of this happening. You don't want to say one of the benefits, but it brings to light this very important issue that I'm sure a lot of parents haven't been thinking of, especially as we're going into the holiday season, you're buying all these toys. Though the kids' information on the sites where they trade people's stolen data goes for double the price of adult information.
Well, I don't know that there's any evidence for that. I mean, I'm not sure that this one specifically with VTech was done maliciously. The things that I've read about it are, and this often happens when you hear about these security breaches, that oftentimes someone will perform the security breach after they've let a company know well in advance that they have a security flaw, and the company does nothing.
Right.
And then sometimes people go in and do it just to prove that it can be done and to bring that daylight onto it.
Make a
because
statement
the company
in the press.
Didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and I would hate to surmise that there was malicious intent against children for this hack in particular. They just happened to have a very, open website that was easily hacked. And, and they're by far not the only ones. You know, the ubiquity of the ability for anyone to spin up this information, to collect information, to ask, for people to sign up. There's just so many out there that are poorly executed. But anyway, I just wanted to make that point to say that I don't know, but I'm sure there are people that treat that data in a kind of more depraved way, but it's just the way that I see it is any of our information that's out there is it's more public than we think it is. I mean, all the photos that you put, I ask my friends with kids before I take their photo, and I certainly ask them before I publish them on social media, but I don't think most people do. But that's public. All of that is 100% public. Anyone could go through Facebook and scrape all of that information. So I think it's, you know, as we build these more sophisticated networks and tools, it's really just a question that we want to ask ourselves. What's our tolerance for having that stuff out in the world?
So whose responsibility is it? Do you think it's the responsibility of the manufacturers? Is it the responsibility of a government agency to put stricter rules on those? Because as I understand in this situation, VTech was following the rules that are in place. And right. yet, obviously, it was not secure enough. So where does that responsibility lie?
That's a great question. I don't remember the company, but there was one company that got a fairly aggressive fine levied against it because they built some piece of web content that had an age gate. It made you go in and put in your information, but it didn't work. The age gate just was broken. Nobody got to the point of trying to put in an age that they shouldn't and testing that. So there was a fine that was levied against that company, and it was significant. I don't remember the details, but it's a great question. I think there's a role for government, but I also recoil at that a little bit. Yeah, I think it is. I can tell you that as a technologist at an agency where, you know, I hear about, you know, we don't want to kill any idea in brainstorming and we want to, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could have people submit a photo of their kid and then we put a show's brand stamp on it and we send this around. We've had those conversations all the time for years. And I think you just have to make sure that you have that balance where you're really thinking about, you know, okay, what are the ramifications for that? What are the security risks for that? What do we have to do just to make sure that we're covered in the event that those databases get out into the world? Because they're just, you know, there are people who will try to make that happen.
So in the case of, well, it really isn't necessarily in the case of VTech, but in the case of any company who there is a security breach that is discovered by, are they called black hats? Is that what the, I feel like I...
Well, a black hat is a hacker with malicious intent.
Oh, okay. So,
but a white hat would be a hacker who is mainly trying to, you know, they have the skills of a hacker, but they often work on behalf of companies.
Yeah.
They do not have malicious intent to find holes in security. They're trying to make us all safer and more secure.
So let's say someone like that, a white hat or whatever you want to call them, like you said, identifies this breach, reaches out to company A, whoever it is, and says, you know, I found this breach. Like, I'm just letting you know, right. like you need to fix it by X date or I'll be releasing this to the New York Times or whoever, you know, why would a company not fix that? I imagine it's either because A, maybe they don't take the letter seriously or, but even then, why?
I don't think there's a good reason, first of all, to answer your question. But I think that things can only matriculate through a very bureaucratic enterprise at a certain speed.
Mm-hmm.
And you just need one person in the chain to turn a deaf ear or not understand the ramifications to shut somebody down. You could have somebody on their web development team or their IT team making all the noise in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But relatively speaking, you know, we've all had that manager who, why are they a manager? You know, if they're not open to the real risks of what's going on, they just might not answer that email. They just might not force it. You know, forward it to the right person.
Yeah.
That's what's so frustrating. And even going back to our previous topic, it's just, this is so important and it's so unbelievable by now. Haven't we learned enough that these people in these departments that handle these issues need to be taking them more seriously? The people in charge need to be vetted more carefully by the companies. Like, we're talking about a lot of people's lives on the line. And it could, for some people, sometimes the fraud that results is when the bad hackers do get in, it can ruin your life for a certain period of time. It could take up your whole life. I just don't understand how we're not, it doesn't seem like the issue is being addressed as quickly as it could be. Like to have the type of bureaucracy that keeps us from advancing as quickly as the bad actors are.
Yeah, it's just there's going to be enough ramifications where people say, you know what, let's not let happen to us what happened to Sony Pictures. Let's make sure that we learn a lesson from this one and make sure that we're as buttoned up as we can be. And, you know, just one final thought on this. I think one of the things we learned recently in some of the research we did for our Mobile Truth event, and Lisa talked really well about this, was, you know, we have assumptions over what people want when they come to our websites. And I think there's a lot of noise being made about the assumptions of personalization. You know, we want to present you with a personalized experience, which usually means we have a whole data record about you where we know stuff. We know what you're looking for. We know what you like. We know what you clicked. And I think it's really interesting because one of the things we're seeing now is people are saying, personalization, that's neat. But you know what? Just make the website clean, easy to understand, and navigable. And if we focus on that stuff and let them tell us what they're there for and don't think we have to ultimately predict everything, then we don't have that data in our servers. It's not there to be lost. So I just think that's an interesting component to the conversation. We have to challenge our assumptions. And I think so much in digital marketing, the assumption is give me as much information about a person as I can possibly have. Well, if you have, you know, a gigabyte of data on every one of your potential customers, that's just a gigabyte of data that could go out the door. So let's really, really challenge that assumption and not just be, you know, complacent and say more data is always better, because now it comes with a risk and a cost.
I think that's a really interesting point, this idea of always the idea of just because you can do something, should you do it? That, to me, that's always an interesting question. You know, the idea of whether that's about efficiency or whatever it is, right. You know, but I think particularly as it relates to data and this idea that really being strategic about the why you're collecting it, what it's for, what you're going to use it for, so that you can, you know, really put a metric against that to decide, is the risk that you inherently carry by carrying that data, is it worth it based on what you can theoretically glean from the use of that data somehow? You know, there's that, to me, all of a sudden, then it helps to put a formula, if you can at all, against something to help identify value.
And just to bring it full circle, we see in the past, in the early days of companies like Facebook, you know, we built engagements where it was like, you know, connect with us on Facebook. We're going to pull in all the pictures of your friends. We're going to do a fun memory match game. Well, you know, Facebook, if we were trying to build that today, Facebook would never allow that to happen. They've really tightened down and taken seriously the information that is shared. And they make you jump through a lot of hoops to say, how is this going to benefit the user? Mm-hmm. If we even let you ask the user to share this, which is not assumed anymore. Mm-hmm. If we even let you ask the question, prove to us, send us screenshots, tell us, how does it make their experience better? If you can't prove that, you get denied. And that's just very different than where we were 5 years ago. And I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, it's going to force us to be creative in different ways about how we, you know, respect that information and about how we get people's attention.
Well, and it also, again, hearkening back to that first topic, it also, if platforms are going to have a stronger hold on the curation of the content that's appearing there, even if it is from the perspective of, is this providing value to the end user, I would argue, I think that that curation also comes with the responsibility of, there's a heavier responsibility to the content that is on the platform. It isn't, it, whether they're saying it or not, their actions are saying that it's not just kind of Facebook and open source. Well, I shouldn't say open source. Facebook, this crazy platform where you can do whatever you want and you know, reach the members however you want. There is a sense of, okay, if they're taking more ownership over how people are being communicated to and what people are being served, then it seems like there's a back end responsibility as well. Well, it's really interesting.
There's a lot, and I think there's a lot that's going to be continue to evolve on this. I know we say that a lot about topics, but this, you know, security is going to be a multi-billion-dollar industry as long as we have networked stuff. So kids out there, if you want a good career, go into internet security. You're gonna have a job. Kevin, can we go and save us from this deep conversation? Dark. Do you have a topic that is lighter?
First of all, I would like to say that I'm going analog. I'm getting rid of all technology in my life. If you need to reach me, I'll give you my home address. You can write me a nice letter.
Don't forget to lock your door.
I will get back to you in 2 to 3 weeks, depending on how the mail works.
I don't think that's the answer.
I don't either, and I could never survive that. Anyway, moving on to my topic, which does touch on your topics a little bit. Well, first, I want to – I have a bone to pick.
Uh-oh.
I'm upset, Jordan.
With what?
I'm upset with two individuals named Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
I've heard
and
of them.
Their vicious assault on advertising, on their comical – that was air quotes. I just realized people can't see my air quotes. Their comical cartoon, South Park. If you haven't been watching, there's been a storyline in which they talk about ads and how manipulative ads are and how they take the form of editorial content. So you don't even realize you're reading an ad when you are looking at an ad, and the ads are advancing so fast that one of the classmates of the main characters in South Park is actually an ad that has adapted to her environment.
It's a human form.
And is living among them.
What do they call her?
Her name is Leslie. So if you know any Leslies, that's what they're going by these days. And in all actuality, it is very funny and hilarious and a great way for people to kind of step back and take a look at a lot of what we're talking about, how they interact with things online and the kind of information they share and what they're looking at. But I do feel like they need to back off a little bit and, you know, just trust us. We know best, South Park, as advertisers. We know what we're doing.
Well, one of the things I liked about the story arc was I think they tried to highlight, and I do watch South Park, and I have enjoyed this season, and they've been really committed to it. But I think one of the things they're trying to highlight is when companies really try to mask something that is an advertisement as something that's not, you know, what is that meter in our heads that goes off? What is that little spidey sense that, you know, we think we're engaging with one type of content, but, you know, really we're being manipulated. I think that's really what they're taking umbrage with is the non-transparent manipulation, you know, which, you know, goes back to lots of different things that we've been talking about. But it's, you know, what if they're among us? What if they all of a sudden, you know, are walking and breathing, reading and living? What if your best friend was an ad? You know, how would that make you feel?
It's too late. I'm already out there. I'm doing this. I'm collecting data on you all and selling it. And yet, no, you're right. It speaks to the ethics question of advertisers and producers of content, and where does the responsibility fall? When is too much? All of that, and that goes into the main thing I really wanted to speak about, which was an article I read about the network effect, which is a project that really challenges you to think about the way you spend your time online on social media, consuming. It's really great. You can go to networkeffect.io, and depending on where you are in the world, they calculate your life expectancy and they turn that into a number. I think I got 7 minutes and 50 seconds.
Oh my.
And I was given 7 minutes and 50 seconds to consume all of this media, audio, pictures, video, all these things. And they were just being thrown at me, and you could toggle through all this information, all these different topic headers and Pinterest and Twitter and people and celebrities. It's so overwhelming. And it is just as they want it to be. You get consumed. I easily got lost for 8 minutes in that. Don't tell my boss.
Just to clarify, 7 minutes wasn't your life expectancy.
I hope not.
I hope that's what I thought of. No, that's how much you had per day.
There's some formula.
I believe they said the average life expectancy in the United States was 78.4 years. So I got 7.84 minutes.
Got it.
Which turned out to be 7 minutes and 50 seconds. That's how they did it. And then once you reach that limit, 24 hours, you get kicked off. You can't go back. And the goal of the project, as I understand it, is to leave you thinking, is this – how do I spend my time online? Is it worth it? Is getting sucked down those wormholes worth the entertainment value of it? And one of the questions that they ask in the article is, what are the ethics of this? We have the bottomless news feed on Facebook. We have the autoplay on Netflix, whereas if you don't press anything, it's just going to keep playing. The way these things – they're designed to keep you there. And they have the growth hackers that are, they keep tweaking it. They keep finding ways to keep you hooked. And obviously they're businesses and they're trying to do what they do, and that's their right. But is there, do they have a responsibility to their users to put those caps on, or at least give them the tools to put the caps on? I think there was a suggestion of, you know, in an app saying, telling the app, okay, once I'm on you for 10 minutes, I want you to shut down. Or at least I want you to tell me, you've been doing this for 10 minutes.
Right.
Do you want to keep going? And it's an interesting question. And they also raise the question of good attention versus bad attention. Because as much as we want to keep people online and consuming the kind of stuff, the content we put out there, at what point are they really consuming it? Because at what point are they just scrolling through, going through the motions? Are they really getting the value that we're trying to add to their lives? I don't know. And so these are the kind of very interesting questions that are asked in the article, and I wanted to talk about it.
Well, I think so much of how long someone spends on a website or how many pages they click through, that all has a financial implication for a lot of sites. Thankfully, we don't work in an industry where that's true. The websites and the digital experiences we make, we're trying to get you to make a decision to have a live experience that's shared with people. So at the end of the day, I rest assured knowing that that's our goal. It's not to kind of keep people in an endless loop, and it's not to try to create the equivalent of a digital slot machine where people just click and click and click endlessly. I think when you have the ability to monitor, you know, someone's behavior, I think the positive effect is, you know, look at the Fitbits or the health software, which is kind of also keeping track and making you aware of something you weren't aware of, but it's doing it a different way. It's saying, you know, every hour we're going to buzz to make sure that you get up and take a walk. So I think, it's the data, the volume of data is going, it could be our curse or it could be our blessing. I don't know, Jordan, what's your take?
Yeah, it's, I think I read the article that you're talking about, because in it, I think they made a comparison to some of the stories and points of view that we hear these days about sugar and about how sugar really is a very addictive substance. And what does that mean for products that contain it? And what's the responsibility of people who are distributing those products, or not necessarily distributing them, of producing those products, to identify that somehow on the packaging? And so there, so I feel that to me was a great example, because it's like, okay, because I don't know, I'm torn on this. Because on one hand, I feel like we're all adults. Like, if you want to spend 13 hours of your day on Instagram, who am I to tell you not to? I can't imagine that it would enhance your life that well. But I don't know.
Jordan, I'm telling you right now, I cannot be trusted. I know this. I don't trust myself. I will consume the media that is online for 24 hours, and I will eat all the sugary candy and products out there while I'm doing it, gladly, unless someone steps in and helps me. This is a call for help.
Just as guilty. My husband even will say to me when I'm going to, I'm like, I'm going to bed. He's like, are you going to bed or are you going to Instagram bed? And normally the answer is Instagram bed. But yes, I am so guilty in that all of a sudden, you know, I'll think to myself, oh, I'm just going to scroll through and like see what I missed today. And I enjoy it. I'm like looking at my sister's Instagrams, but then all of a sudden, yes, like you go down a hole and 25 minutes has passed and it's like embarrassing, you know?
Well, because we've amassed all this content because so many people are creating it. You can just go on forever.
Yeah.
Actually, that's, I think, my new project. I'm announcing my resignation today from the situation. Starting today, I'm going to try to consume all of the data in the world just by clicking hashtags and links until the end of time.
Yeah.
Or me. I don't know.
Love your declarations, Kevin, given that not 5 minutes ago you were going completely analog. This is the opposite end of the pendulum from that.
That's true.
This is now I'm consuming everything that's out there.
I just said it. I don't trust myself. I obviously don't make good decisions, and I make them quickly. I need to be regulated.
Impulsive. Someone help me.
Hey, guys. Sorry about that edit. We wanted to let the siren clear by. One of the joys of recording here on the 20th floor at Situation Studios is all the wonderful street noise. But anyway, so I think now we're ready to go into something a little more joyous. Let's go around the table and talk about something that we don't want our listeners to miss this week. Kevin, why don't you kick us off?
Well, going back to our endless need to consume sugar forever and always. Right now at the New York Hall of Science through January 9th, you can walk through 500 square feet and over 1,050 gingerbread houses. They're created by this chef, John Lovitch, who has won the Guinness World Record for the largest gingerbread village in 2013, 2014. He's going for a third year in the row. You could just go and marvel at the confectionery wonderfulness that is a huge gingerbread village made completely out of edible material. So
wow.
If you're feeling saucy and just want to go for it, I can't promise security won't stop you, but it is truly a wonderland.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That must smell amazing.
Oh, just yeah. I didn't think of that.
Well, that's a great one. Jordan, what about you? What shouldn't people miss?
Mine's in the world of food. It's more beverage related. This is just if you're looking for a perfect spot, if maybe you have family coming to town, maybe you just need a special night, there's this place in the Time Warner Center called Center Bar that is, I think, on the second or third floor, but it's literally just located when you come off the escalator in the center of the Time Warner Center. And it's got amazing views of Central Park. They have a pianist in there playing. It's very nice, but it's not stuffy. And it's just, I haven't been there this holiday season yet, but it's on my list of one of those things where it's like looking out over the park. The Time Warner Center always has like kind of really beautiful Christmas light decoration, holiday things hanging. I feel like it's just would be the perfect experience for kind of ringing in the holidays over the next couple weeks.
That sounds great. A nice escape from the madness of the street. Well, my thing that I don't think people should miss, especially if they're in New York, and hopefully he's still around. But last week, a friend of mine sent me a news article about a bird that had shown up in Prospect Park, which is right across the street from where I live, called a painted bunting. And if you Google image search this bird, it's crazy. It looks like Cyndi Lauper's hairstyles came together to make a bird. It's beautiful. It's blue. It's very bright and vibrant. And I haven't seen the bird, but I've seen lots of people looking for the bird in Prospect Park as I walk my dog. And even though I haven't seen it, it's bringing joy to my world knowing that it's there, knowing that it's right across the street. My stepdad is a huge birder. I sent it over to him and my mom, and they're excited. So if you have a chance to come to the park, you know, while it's still warm, weirdly warm in this December, but come and try to find the painted bunting because you might see him.
What a good name.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very creative. Yeah.
I hear it does whistle Cyndi Lauper covers as well.
Nice.
So that's its bird song.
That's good.
Birds just want to have fun, Kevin.
Whoa.
All right. On that note, I want to thank you guys so much for listening to our podcast. If you have feedback, we'd love to hear from our listeners. Please send us an email to podcast@situation.nyc. I want to thank the reunited triumvirate of Kevin, Jordan, and myself. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
We will see you guys in a couple of weeks. Take care.